so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with my friend Chris Hedges. He writes at Bob Shearer's Shear Post, and he has many, many, many wonderful books about the political economy of this world. The most recent is America, the Farewell Tour. I understand next year he's got a book coming out on mass incarceration, and I look forward to that. Historically, Chris was a reporter and worked primarily with the New York Times for about 20 years in the Middle East and in the Balkan region. Lastly, and on a personal note, Chris and I shared great admiration for a mutual friend, James Cohn, who passed away a couple of years ago. But I remember enjoying many conversations with you and he and a couple of dinners together. And I just wanted to remember him as you and I get together. At any rate, Chris, thanks for joining. Thanks for being here. And tell me, as you look, we're in the middle of this tumultuous year, presidential election, a pandemic that seems to have intensified. And I'm just curious, what are you seeing? And what are you seeing that gives you alarm? What are you not seeing you wish you were seeing? And what are you seeing that gives you some basis for hope?
Well, the structures of democratic capitalism have been severely weakened. That's a decades-long process, probably begun, if you want a start date, around 1971 with the Powell memo. That's the memo by Lewis Powell, who was the chief attorney for the Chamber of Commerce, that laid out a kind of blueprint by which corporate America could respond to what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called derisively America's excess of democracy. Those were the rise of popular grassroots movements, not just the anti-war movement, but the feminist movement, the ecological movement, Earth Day. Ralph Nader, by the way, was the original organizer of Earth Day. Citizens action committees led by Nader. Nader was actually named in that memo as a target. And what we've seen since is a frontal assault against all popular movements that gave not only a voice, but power to the citizenry, especially labor unions. If we all remember Reagan going after the air traffic controllers union, but you know, this has culminated with right to work laws. So at this point, about 6% of the labor force is unionized, and then of course we've seen all of the policies, deindustrialization, turbocharged by NAFTA. The destruction of social programs such as welfare. Again, that was the Clinton administration. That was a Democratic administration. So welfare is, in essence, eradicated. 70% of the original recipients of welfare were children. You saw the repeal of the 1933 law Glass-Steagall, which had put a firewall between commercial and investment banks. That was destroyed, which precipitated the global meltdown. It's interesting that Canada, which did under Chrétien, did not tear down those firewalls and thus did not have a banking crisis with the global meltdown. You saw constant deregulation, including of the FCC, which as a journalist was important because that allowed the consolidation of especially electronic media, but not exclusively, into the hands of about a half dozen corporations that control what about 90% of Americans listen to and watch. You saw a defunding of public television and public radio, which then became dependent on corporate money. So if you went back and looked at public television in the 1970s, you could see critics, corporate critics, critics of imperialism like Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, even earlier before he was assassinated, Malcolm X. But all of that's been eradicated. And we've reconfigured the capitalist democracy into a system of oligarchy. It's been seized by global speculators who have carried out, because their lobbyists write the legislation, virtual tax boycotts. Amazon didn't pay taxes, at least last year. In fact, it got money back. You've seen a massive consolidation of personal wealth in terms of the hands of, you know, the billionaire class. And I think most egregiously, that money corrupted the Democratic Party. And that was a conscious decision by Tony Coelho, who, a congressman in California, who, along with Clinton, realized that they could get corporate money if they did corporate bidding. David K. Johnston wrote a good book, No Free Lunch, where he talks about how that effort to attract corporate dollars just began this massive rewriting of tax laws. If you go back under Eisenhower, the wealthiest segment of the population and the wealthiest corporations paid 91% income tax. What you saw, and I learned much of this from Ralph Nader, who was turned into a pariah consciously, is that they pushed out the real liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Ralph himself wrote, I think, 24 pieces of legislation, consumer protection, the Mine and Safety Act, the Clean Water Act. This was all Nader, but it was pushed through by liberal senators, Proxmire, Fulbright, and others. Wellstone, maybe even one of the last. All of these people were pushed out of the Democratic Party and replaced with this faux liberal, I would call them faux liberals, figures like Obama, figures like Clinton, who spoke in that traditional feel-your-pain language of the Democratic Party, but served the interests of Wall Street. Cornel West called Barack Obama a black mascot for Wall Street, which was correct. And what you really got was the transformation of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. The Republican Party was pushed so far to the right that it just became insane, and we're watching its insanity at the moment. But this left the working class absolutely bereft. The Democratic establishment essentially justifies this savage assault by being tolerant on issues of sexual identity and race. You see Biden attempting to put women and Buttigieg, who's gay, and people of color on the cabinet. But this is just corporate colonialism. They certainly serve, like Obama, those centers of power. And that has completely disenfranchised and enraged, and I think that the feeling of rage is legitimate, the white working class. And I have a particular sensitivity to the dispossession of the white working class because I come out of it in Maine. And I have watched the destruction of these people where my relatives were working or lower working class. NAFTA and trade deals and have just destroyed their lives and destroyed their communities. So if you, for instance, go to the town that my grandparents are from, Mechanic Falls, Maine, it's a wreck. It's a ruin. That everything is boarded up. Even the bank in the center of town, a small town, is boarded up. The church in front of the house where my grandparents lived burned down, and the town doesn't have the money to raise it. So it's just blackened, charred embers. The desperation has fueled the opioid crisis. That is true throughout the country. I wrote a book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, with Joe Sacco, out of West Virginia. These were sacrifice zones. You know, we went to the poorest parts of the United States. Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in America, to say, look, this is what unfettered capitalism has done to these sacrifice zones, and now we've just become one vast sacrifice zone. And then, you know, accompanying this dispossession of the white working class, which does express much of its rage in racist, even homophobic, Islamophobic terms. I'm not defending any of this, but I think we have to just write these people off as racists is not to understand what happened. You saw a radical transformation in the media, and I think Matt Taibbi has probably done the best work on this. Read his book, Hate Inc. It's a very good analysis of what's happened to the media landscape. One half of the cover of the book shows Sean Hannity, the other Rachel Maddow, because they do the same thing. So if you go back and look at Manufacturing Consent, Chomsky and Ed Herman's great work on the press, you see that the old paradigm no longer functions, that in the digital age, where there are a multiplicity of sources, the media has essentially siloed itself. It doesn't seek as the old, with the old monopolies. Remember, we used to have just one major network. The power of the New York Times, and I know because I worked for the Times for 15 years, was not the readership. The readership wasn't ever that big. The subscription base was rarely over much over a million, but it was the power to set the agenda. So that when I was overseas, all of the networks, now these were the big kind of media stars that appeared on CBS or NBC, would actually come and knock on my hotel room at night and ask me what it was I was filing the next morning, because they knew their editors would then send them out to do a story based on what I had reported. That was the power of the New York Times. All of that's gone. And it's been replaced by partisan divides. And it has transformed publications like the New York Times into partisan outlets. The Pew Research Center did a poll last summer where they polled readers and viewers. So 91% of the people who read the New York Times identify as supporters of the Democratic Party. That's 87% for National Public Radio, 94-95%, I can't remember, for MSNBC. And then you have the other side of the divide, where 95% of the people who watch Fox News, I hate combining Fox with the word news, identify as supporters of the Republican Party. And that has been commercially successful, and even politically successful, because on all of the major issues, trade deals, endless war, wholesale surveillance, austerity programs, there's really almost no difference between the Republican and the Democratic Party. Their difference revolves around what I would call societal or ethical issues, which are not unimportant, but they're not social or political issues. And so you have this kind of what Freud called fratricides, you know, centered around the narcissism of minor difference. And that's essentially what we're seeing. It's essentially, you know, sweeping up, because we're all of our profiles are available, our own proclivities and habits and prejudices, and then feeding it back to us. The danger of this is that you're creating a wider divide where people can no longer communicate, where nothing is based on verifiable fact or truth. And I fault the left as much as the right for this. You know, the whole obsession with Russiagate, the whole attempt to blame the election of Trump on Moscow was really a deflection away from the complicity that the Democratic Party had in the dispossession of the working class. And that's very frightening. And of course, we're watching now the Biden, people around Biden, ratchet up a new Cold War. If you go back and remember when Biden's campaign was faltering, he blamed, right after the Nevada caucus, where Bernie Sanders shellacked him, I mean, got more than double the votes that he did. I think he got about 20%. Bernie got almost 50%. He blamed it. He said, well, that's, of course, because, you know, the Russians want Bernie Sanders. This goes back to Clinton during the 2016 blasting Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, as a Russian asset, a line she repeated during the Democratic primaries this year, trying to tar Representative Tulsi Gabbard, again, as a Russian asset. And I think that it's clear from the Biden appointments, and we can go through them if you want, but it's clear from the Biden appointments that we're going to get more of the same. And the fact is, most Americans on both sides of the political spectrum do not want more of the same. And I worry that what they will do is what, you know, ruling parties always do, and that is essentially create an enemy. They can't go after China because Silicon Valley will never let them, and because China, frankly, is too powerful. So they'll go after Russia, which is much weaker. You've already seen it with this kind of cyber attack, or when Hunter Biden's laptop was discovered with all sorts of damaging emails and apparently pictures of him smoking crack and having sex or whatever. Again, that was an attempt to tar this as Russian disinformation. Again, if you look at even the New York Times, when they talk about the John Podesta emails, these were the he was Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, which were published by WikiLeaks. It's described as disinformation. Well, as a journalist, this is very frightening. It's not disinformation. Those emails were true. Nobody has ever challenged the veracity of those emails. So on the one hand, we've seen a kind of savaging of the country by rapacious global corporate entities, which are supranational and have no loyalty to the nation state at all. Ralph Nader correctly calls them traitors. Coupled with the breakdown of a media system which sets one demographic against another. I'll just close by saying that, you know, we must never forget that Donald Trump received the second highest vote count in any presidential race in American history, 74 million voters, and Biden got about 80. Now, this is after one of the most disastrous presidencies in American history, flagrant corruption, ineptitude, racism, appointing conspiracy theorists, etc. He increased his vote count by and not being able to handle the pandemic, although it's not completely his fault. The for-profit healthcare system is not designed to handle a national health crisis. It's designed to make money, which that is going to be a problem under a Biden. But so he increased his vote count by 11 million votes. And that has to be a huge flashing red light. So watching the Biden administration go back to more of the same, it has apparently rebuffed Bernie Sanders' desire to be Secretary of Labor. They just refused to allow Ocasio-Cortez to be on the Energy Committee. Because of the Green New Deal, the Energy and Commerce Committee, because of her support of the Green New Deal. It's clear, and also because virtually all of the nominees, including Nara Tandon, this former Clinton aide who has been picked to be director of the Office of Management and Budget, and who spent the last 9 years running the Democratic Party's think tank, the Center for American Progress, is openly ridiculed. Sanders and Sanders supporters. So that's where we are, and it's a decades-long march. It's not something that was caused by a particular election cycle. These are structural, major structural dilemmas that I see no party addressing in a real way. You're watching Giuliani and Trump attempt to use the same kind of conspiracy theories, you know, that Venezuelan software designed by Hugo Chavez, who died in 2013, for corrupting the election. I mean, just it's as ludicrous as blaming the Kremlin for Trump's rise. But this is a characteristic of two parties that refuse to confront their own responsibility for where we are, and a media that no longer informs, but essentially caters to a particular demographic, and demonizes the other demographic. So, and then we didn't talk about the climate crisis, which is, of course, an emergency is the right word. So all of these things come together, and I think that the lesson from both this election and the pandemic is that we are losing control, both as a nation and as a species.
Losing control in part, how would I say, because as you and Matt Taibbi discussed in your show On Contact, that the journalists have now been intimidated. They're afraid to share with the American people, how you say, what's the crux of the issue. And as a result, all of these kind of, how I say, false explanations become, the bloodstream of conversation. And people can intuitively sense that people aren't addressing what fuels their despair. How do you explain that? I mean, I understand what you're talking about vis-a-vis corporate structure and the media, et cetera, but the outrage, particularly white working class, felt, Donald Trump seemed to speak to that when he'd say the system is rigged, or he'd show videos of Hillary Clinton before giving a speech before Lloyd Blankfein and Goldman Sachs or what have you. But what's going on now that's, what you might call, kept Trump's votes so high? What did the Democrats not do in the campaign that inhibited them from winning in a landslide?
Well, they could have won in a landslide if they addressed the real issues. In poll after poll, everybody, Republican, Democrat, feels that Wall Street's out of control, that they should be more heavily regulated and taxed. These endless wars have no support. This insane pillaging of resources by the defense industry. I mean, in a normal society, the architects of failed wars and failed policies should be at best dismissed and probably even put on trial. There certainly should be the kinds of investigations that a functioning democracy engages in. We saw that with Watergate. We saw that with a church committee. All of that's gone. It was Feinstein, actually. I'm no fan of Feinstein, but it was Feinstein who attempted to investigate the CIA torture program, and the CIA hacked her own computers, the Senate computers. And there was this moment where she just came out kind of white as a ghost and realized that there was going to be no control over the kind of dark intelligence agencies whose budgets are dark. We don't even know how much. We have to guess how much these intelligence agencies are being allotted. And so the system is rigged in this sense. If corporate money was removed from the election and political process, then figures like Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or even Mitch McConnell wouldn't exist. They are products of this money. They are the servants to this billionaire class, to these corporate entities. And their power comes from being able to anoint and fund the candidates that they choose that will do the bidding of corporate power. And without that money, they vanish. Without that money, Bernie Sanders clearly would have been the nominee in 2016. Remember, Bernie did not take corporate money. This was a true grassroots effort. And I have criticism of Sanders, but this was a true grassroots effort. But the oligarchic elite was quite open that Bernie Sanders would never be the nominee. There was all sorts of dirty tricks in both 2016 and 2020, using the DNC as a vehicle to support the Clinton campaign quite openly. In 2016, they openly stole the Nevada caucus. They denied independents in many states the right to vote in Democratic primaries, although we should remember the taxpayer pays for the primaries. They erased all sorts of people from the rolls. They used superdelegates. These tactics were all in place again. So the Democratic Party, I think, committed kind of suicide. I think that the Biden administration will cede the ground for a competent fascist. And the only thing that saved us from a coup d'etat, which the Trump administration clearly was and is trying to orchestrate, is just their disorganization and their ineptitude. But putting a competent fascist like Mike Pompeo or Tom Cotton linked to the Christian right, and I am a seminary graduate, and I'm glad you mentioned James Cone, my close friend and the greatest theologian in America since Reinhold Niebuhr. These people are, you know, this Christian right, this prosperity gospel is heretical. And I don't say that lightly. I have a deep church background. My father was a minister. My mother was a seminary graduate, although she was a professor. At one point could read the Bible in Greek. I mean, I know it. And the failure of the liberal church to denounce these people for who they were in the name of tolerance and dialogue has been disastrous. The Christian right, 81%, the last figure I read, support Trump. They have acculturated the Christian message to the worst aspects of American capitalism and American imperialism. This kind of heretical belief that the white race is blessed to kind of bring the Christian society. And let's remember that Jesus wasn't white. The Romans were white. Jesus was a person of color. That's the first of many lies. Islam, and I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I'm an Arabic speaker and have a deep, deep respect for Islam, is a kind of satanic religion. That's where both the ideology and the infrastructure, the patina, will come from. That Christian fascism will be the veneer. And Trump brought these people really into the epicenter of power. Mike Pence, Betsy DeVos, Bill Barr, Carson, they all come out of this. And then, of course, we've got 6 of 9 Supreme Court justices who have all been anointed, are products of the Federalist Society, including this cultist, Amy Coney Barrett. We've got 20% of federal judgeships were appointed during the Trump administration, but Trump just turned it all over to the Federalist Society. And most of these appointees were rated as unqualified by the American Bar Association. So we are, I think in the kind of meltdown that's happening, we are laying the groundwork for a kind of Christianized fascism. And I think that if the Democratic Party attempts to go back to what they call normal, and I think at this point it's very clear from the Biden appointments, which are drawn almost exclusively from the circles of the Democratic Party and the corporate elite, and these are the people that created the orchestrated the social inequality, the trade deals, the militarized police. Biden was one of the prime movers behind that, along with the doubling of our prison population, now the largest in the world. He repeatedly called for cuts to Social Security, wholesale surveillance. All of this came out of Biden and the Democrats, and the appointees that he has brought forward for his new administration are rooted completely in that corporate elite and in that ideology. And that's what I find very dangerous and very frightening.
How would I say? I remember when you were talking about Nancy Pelosi, that, or Chuck Schumer or whatever, that or Mitch McConnell, they're dependent on the money. Without the money, they wouldn't be there. My sense is that the system is so designed to favor money over votes as a currency for decision making that almost every elected official faces that pressure. And when we talk about different policies, not working on climate change, excessive financial deregulation, pharmaceutical monopolies, stock buybacks, aren't all of these symptoms of that malfunctioning system where money and concentrated wealth and the non-enforcement of antitrust, which further concentrate its wealth, aren't these the contributing factors that render how'd I say, each politician vulnerable to defeat if they don't cope with this. So that's what needs to be reformed.
At they're the not going to reform it, because if they reform it, they're going to lose power. And Pelosi and Schumer, they're quite aware of this. So on the one hand, the Democratic Party, look, imagine if the Democratic Party campaigned on universal health care, a guaranteed minimum wage for all, forgiveness of student debt, complete moratorium on foreclosures and evictions, an end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a government jobs program. I mean, they would sweep the elections. But of course, they wouldn't have their corporate backers like Lloyd Blankfein. I mean, Blankfein, which comes out of the criminal organization of Goldman Sachs, Blankfein made it very clear, he was the former CEO, during the elections that if, and this was, he was quoted in the New York Times, along with other high-profile Democratic donors, that if Sanders was the nominee, he would vote for Trump. So what does that say? It says that the billionaire class, of course they prefer Biden and Silicon Valley and Wall Street at the end of the campaign pumped, we don't know how much because it was through super PACs, but significant sums of money into anti-Trump ads on behalf of Biden. Because Biden restores the kind of gravitas and decorum and civility that was lacking in the Trump administration. But the fact is they can live with either. They prefer Biden and they got Biden over Trump. But what they weren't ever going to accept was Sanders. Even though I find Sanders' political platform quite moderate, Sanders did not go after the defense industry. Sanders was very hesitant to call out the Democratic Party in any real way. And I was outside the appropriately named Wells Fargo Center in 2016 when Sanders got up to endorse the nomination of Hillary Clinton. I was there with Cornel West. We were with a group of several thousand homeless people demanding housing as a human right. And a few hundred Sanders delegates, mostly young, walked out of the hall chanting, this is what democracy, what does democracy look, this is what democracy looks like. And Cornell, who's amazingly prescient as always, said to me, you know, Bernie missed his historical moment. And I think that's right. I think that And I spoke to Bernie Sanders about it. I did an event with him the night before the climate march with Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and the socialist city councilwoman, Shama Sawan, who Amazon is determined to remove from the city council in Seattle. Bernie, you know, Shama and I were pushing, particularly Shama was pushing Bernie to run as an independent, arguing correctly that the Democratic Party was never going to allow him to get the nomination. And Bernie said, well, I don't want to end up like Nader. And I thought that was a very revealing comment because Bernie wasn't wrong. He understood that if he defied the Democratic Party establishment, of course, he would no longer be able to caucus with the Democratic Party and get seniority through the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party would also go after him in Vermont. And make sure that he was not reelected to the Senate. If you defy those corporate interests, they're pretty ruthless. George McGovern was one of the last to do it when he took on the animal ag industry, and they went and they made sure that his Senate seat was taken from him in South Dakota. After, of course, the oligarchic class, Democratic and Republican, conspiring in 1972 with when he got the nomination. You know, the Republican and Democrats conspiring to destroy the McGovern campaign, which they did. Bernie wasn't wrong, but we're never going to build a significant resistance movement in an election cycle. And I know because I've worked with Ralph, I was Ralph's speechwriter, I know all of the impediments the two parties, both parties, but in particular the Democratic Party, throw up to third-party candidates, locking them out of the debates, constantly challenging voter lists, not because they think they're fraudulent, but because it runs up legal bills. At one point, Ralph's legal bills were over $1 million. Patty Smith and I were going around trying to raise money for him to pay it. I think that was, and that, you know, Sanders, I think, chose his career over, and I think, you know, unlike most politicians, I sense that Bernie is honest. And I think that his commitment to the working class is real. I don't think it's fake like John Edwards and all these other people. But I think in the end, he just did not want to confront the monolith because he knew how destructive that monolith would be to him and to his career. And he's not wrong. But I think that also makes him kind of morally and temperamentally unfit to lead this fight.
I'm reminded of a quote from our friend James H. Cone in his book, God of the Oppressed, where he says, "The only meaningful Christian response is to resist unjust suffering and to accept the painful consequence of that resistance." Now, in Bernie's case, he's not necessarily a Christian, but the point is that in such a misaligned system as you're describing, if you don't accept the painful consequence of the resistance, then the resistance is not formidable, and then things continue to careen further and further off course, deepening despair, and produce the kind of authoritarian lurches that we've seen, how you say, periodically throughout history. So the question is, and I can see from your title of your book, "The Fair America, the Farewell Tour," or some of your recent articles, that I guess I would conjecture that you probably don't believe that the energy, the will of resistance, can overcome the tools or the power of the other side, and that we are headed towards that danger zone again. Actually, we've kind of been in it. Trump was a symptom of that in the minds of many people, but it feels to me like we're, how would I say, Cornel West and I were texting on the day when it was announced that Biden won in Pennsylvania, which looked like would clinch sufficient electoral votes to win. And in our interaction, we kind of said, this is an eerie day because what we're doing is celebrating the return to power, the thing that caused what we are celebrating is leaving. And that, and as you've underscored, I think the real danger here is with systemic malfunction of this depth and degree and resilience. How are we going to get back to the structures of what you call democratic capitalism?
Well, that's exactly right. But it also has a very negative effect in terms of the promotion of the kind of liberal, with a small L, the liberal democratic values that you and I and Cornell care so deeply about. So when you have a liberal class, and I think at this point, you know, to define the liberal class, we would call them the professional managerial class that is predominant on the two, on the East Coast and the West Coast, that is tolerant in terms of its attitudes towards different sexual orientations and race and that kind of stuff. But that has largely profited from the ravages of neoliberalism. And I think that they, you know, want to endow it with this kind of patina of civility. The problem is that all of the issues they claim to care about and to fight for, they surrender every election cycle to support figures like Clinton or Biden or Obama, who in power have essentially betrayed all of those issues. And that is eviscerating the credibility of the liberal elite. That's a fundamental component to the rise of any totalitarian movement. That was true in Yugoslavia. You had an ineffectual, self-identified democratic liberal elite after the death of Tito in 1980, in that kind of decade-long period before the war began, but it was just ineffectual. It wasn't able to actually carry out or respond in a meaningful way. There was economic devastation in Yugoslavia. It's a longer story, but they, Tito had gotten a lot of loans. Mostly they knew he could never pay them back because he was a buffer state. And then they wanted, the Western banks wanted the loans paid. They couldn't pay them. Widespread factory closures. The economy went into a tailspin, hyperinflation, etc. So I think that, you know, Ralph's understanding when he decided to run for president, and I was one I agreed with, was that the only tactic that could force the Democrats to adopt part of these kind of progressive agendas and save ourselves from this slow-motion corporate coup d'etat was to defect. That if 5, 10, 15 million people, I'm quoting Ralph, left the Democratic Party behind a third-party candidate, a progressive third-party candidate, this would be the only chance we would have for effective political change. That didn't happen for many reasons. And here, of course, is where we are. I would recommend, I don't know if you know it, Richard Rorty's last book, Achieving Our Country. I think it was written in 1998.
I've read it. Yeah, I've read it. Yeah.
And he nailed it. And I'm just going to read this paragraph. He's talking precisely about this process. Many writers on socioeconomic policy have warned that the old industrialized democracies are heading into a Weimar-like period, one in which populist movements are likely to overturn constitutional governments. Edward Luttwak, for example, has suggested that fascism may be the American future. The point of his book, The Endangered American Dream, is that members of labor unions and unorganized, unskilled workers will sooner or later realize that their government is not even trying to prevent wages from sinking or to prevent jobs from being exported. And let's just, as a caveat, remember that wages in real terms have declined since the 70s. Production has risen by 77%. If wages had kept pace with production, the minimum wage would be $20 an hour. And then I'm going back to Rorty. Around the same time, they will realize that suburban white-collar workers, themselves desperately afraid of being downsized, are not going to let themselves be taxed to provide social benefits for anyone else. At that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for, someone willing to assure them that once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen, and postmodernist professors will no longer be calling the shots. A scenario like that of Sinclair Lewis's novel It Can't Happen Here may then be played out. For once such a strong man takes office, nobody can predict what will happen. In 1932, most of the predictions made about what would happen if Hindenburg named Hitler chancellor were wildly over-optimistic. One thing that is very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black and brown Americans and by homosexuals will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. The N-word and kike will once again be heard in the workplace. All the sadism which the academic left has tried to make unacceptable to its students will come flooding back. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet. I recommend that book and Sheldon Wolin's classic Democracy Incorporated, two political prophets, contemporary with their both died recently. Well, Rorty, not so recently, Wolin a couple years ago. If you go on YouTube, I have the last interview Wolin gave. It's a 3-hour interview he gave to me the year before he died. They, you know, these political philosophers astutely saw the danger and what was coming and the consequences, and here we are.
Wendy Brown, who's been a guest on this podcast, was a student of Sheldon Wolin's.
Right. You know who else was a student of Sheldon Wolin? Cornel West. Cornel dedicated his second book to Sheldon Wolin. And when Sheldon Wolin...
And my own research director, I'm sorry to interrupt, but my own research director, Tom Ferguson, was also at Princeton and did some work with Sheldon
Wolin. Told me there came a point when no member of the Princeton political science department was even speaking to him because he called neoliberalism out in the 80s and he was immediately purged. Interestingly, about Wolin is that he's quite a lyrical writer. He's quite a fine writer. He's a brilliant philosopher, but he's also a very good writer. And so he was writing for publications like the New York Review of Books and others, but he saw what was coming and he said he just got blanked out. He couldn't get published.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember talking with Chalmers Johnson a little bit about knowing Wolin and his admiration.
Well, Johnson is another. Johnson's trilogy is another one. Sorrows of Empire.
That's right.
Also very, very smart books. So, you know, we had there were members of our intellectual class who didn't sell out and were honest enough mm-hmm. to warn us, but we didn't listen. And now we're in really deep trouble.
Well, you, in your most recent article, The Great Delusion, you referred to a European scholar, Stefan Zweig, and I thought it was very interesting, the mindset that he portrayed in, what was it called, The World of Yesterday?
That's his memoir.
Uh-huh.
Well, Zweig, you know, so there was a handful of great intellectuals, many of them Jewish, like Zweig. Joseph Roth was another one. They were close friends who certainly saw, mm-hmm. number one, the folly of World War I, the suicidal folly of World War I, for which they immediately became pariahs. And Zweig wrote this great play, Jeremiah, this anti-war play that could only be performed in Switzerland, that issued these kinds of warnings and how you turn on the prophet. So, you know, the biblical prophet, Jeremiah, who's warning Jerusalem about the eventual, when it happens, the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians, is just ignored and ridiculed and persecuted, and there are plots against his life. I'm talking about the biblical story. He's attacked for demoralizing the people, and then by the time the Babylonian army swarms into Jerusalem and the Jews go into exile, Jeremiah, like Julian Assange, is in prison. So they're there, another great figure like that would be Jane Addams in the United States. Go back and look at her, Randolph Bourne. When things become difficult, it's the intellectual class, the majority of the intellectual class, either remains silent or becomes complicit. Because you know, you mentioned earlier, much earlier in the talk, about journalists. Well, what they are is careerists. I worked at the New York Times. There were never rules written on the walls of the New York Times, but you learn very quickly those stories which would get you promoted, that the hierarchy of the Times wanted in the newspaper, and those stories that didn't. And if you persisted with stories they didn't want, you became a management problem, and then you got pushed out. I was friends with Sidney Shanberg, who, of course, won the Pulitzer in Cambodia, and also friends with Dith Prawn, who was eventually, after being in concentration camps run by Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, worked for the New York Times. But Sidney, when he came back, went after the developers who were destroying Manhattan. Manhattan's been destroyed. I used to go to the Village as a boy with all the bookstores and the artists. It's all gone, replaced by, I don't know, Blue Navy or Gap or whatever. These, you know, it's just been sucked dry, the cultural life of the city. And Shanberg saw it, and he went after it, and these developers were friends of the publisher, and he was fired. And he ended up, the rest of his career was writing columns for the Village Voice and Newsday. So the journalists, I think, that are left are largely very cynical, that they are careerists. George Packer, you know, all these kinds of figures, and they are the ones whose voices you hear. Jeffrey Toobin, who's been removed from the airwaves for exposing himself on a Zoom video for watching porn. But Toobin, I debated at the Oxford Union over Snowden, and he was calling for Snowden's extradition and imprisonment, along with Julian. So, but if you stand up for, I mean, I have huge admiration for Snowden and Julian. I know Julian. I visited him several times at the embassy. If you stand up for the, then you're locked out. Your voice is not going to be heard. So I think careerism has really been quite insidious. And also, you know, I would also say about the media kind of cynicism. So, you know, what is balance? Balance becomes inviting a Republican operative, a Giuliani on one side, and or Democratic operative Van Jones on the other, or I don't know who, you know, George Stephanopoulos, or I don't know who these people are. I don't own a television, but, you know, on the other, and they both lie, but you just give them equal time to lie. I think that a certain, I mean, I don't have a much respect for the intellectual wattage power of most of the people on television, but some of them have to know that they're lying. But if you give 4 minutes to Republican lies and 4 minutes to Democratic lies, you've done nothing to actually inform. In fact, you've misinformed the American public, but that becomes what is defined as objective or neutral journalism. But it's really, at this point, all a burlesque. It's all vaudeville, as Taibbi points out. Political coverage is quite consciously modeled after ESPN, with the graphics and the scores and the polls and the numbers and the tactics and the strategies and the good-looking host and two people from one team and two people from another team, but it has nothing to do with politics or civic life.
I remember talking with Julian Tett, who wrote for the Financial Times, and I was asking her about this Institute for New Economic Thinking and what kind of guidance she would give me. And she said at the time, "Rob, what you need to do is study the silences, because the map of the silences and what's not said will tell you where power resides." And I remember H.L. Mencken wrote a piece in the 1920s called The Dismal Science. And he said, and you and I can laugh a little bit, the only people he trusted less than theologians were economists, because they could see in the future what the consequences would be if they espoused a view that took on power or affected the material conditions of trustees and members of the board, et cetera, at the major universities. So he said, these people are not free. And it sounds a little bit like what you say about the journalists, but it also, it reminds me of the Niebuhr quote that you used in your most recent article, where he says, one of the most pathetic aspects of human history is that every civilization expresses itself most pretentiously, compounds its partial and universal values most convincingly, and claims immortality for its finite existence at the very moment when the decay which leads to death has already begun. And my sense is that when things are unsustainable, and in part because of concentrations in power, people become afraid and they go silent, or they compose false consciousness to what you might call avoid confrontation with what looks like it could become inevitable.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I would defer to you in terms of economists, but the whole ideology of neoliberalism as a layman never made any economic sense to me at all. I look at neoliberalism in Marxian terms. I'm not a Marxist, although I think Marx's analysis of capitalism is important. I don't, you know, this whole Hegelian idea of the proletariat, I think, is kind of utopian. But the whole idea of neoliberalism, which reaches back to these real outliers like Hayek and Milton Friedman and mm-hmm. this third-rate novelist Ayn Rand, it was really, as Marx would argue, it was just the ideology that perpetuated the interests of the ruling elites. It's not that it ever made economic sense, nor was it really designed to. And this, of course, is David Harvey's argument in his book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, which I think is correct. And so if you wanted to advance within the university in an economics department, then you better subscribe to that mantra. Whether it makes economic sense or not is irrelevant. But you know more about this than I do.
Yeah, that whole kind of libertarian energy certainly has played a big role in the ideology of Silicon Valley, which is in some ways kind of ironic, given the extent to which Silicon Valley's prosperity was spawned by government direction and government grants through DARPA and the NSA and places like that. And so, it's become quite severe. And then the inability of enforcement, as you talked about, has facilitated a concentration because there is no antitrust. And now more and more outlets, including the New York Post, as you and Matt Taibbi discussed, can get barred just by decisions from a handful of people.
That's very frightening. So I've been hit with these algorithms, which began a couple years ago, supposedly going after left-wing sites because of this anonymous website called Prop or Not, Propaganda or Not. The Washington Post put it on the front page, and they just listed every left-wing site, all of which either runs my stuff or I write for, as being part of the Russian propaganda campaign, Black Agenda Report, Counterpunch, Truth Dig, on and on and on. And then that gave them the ability to use algorithms to shut us out, which they have used. And that's not conjecture. We all went on strike at Truth Dig when the publisher tried to fire Bob Scheer, who now runs his own little site, SheerPost, which we all defected to. We were all fired. But the year before, they got the data to put together a graph which showed referrals through impressions. So you type in, let's say you went into Google and typed imperialism, and I had written an article about imperialism recently, then that should have come up along with anything else about imperialism. But that becomes erased. So referrals to the articles that I had written on the site by impressions in that graph over a 12-month period declined from over 700,000 to below 200,000, and I'm sure it's below that now. And Taibbi, of course, has, I think, been the best on this. But yes, on the Hunter Biden laptop issue, nobody, which they tried to dismiss again as Russian disinformation, nobody's challenged, nobody in the Biden campaign challenged the authenticity of what was on that laptop. And when the New York Post reported it, which is what a journalist should do, Twitter locked them out of their own account. There was a concerted effort by the digital platforms and the traditional mainstream media to bury the story. Now, why is there collusion between Google, Facebook, and organizations like the New York Times? Because they lock out the dissidents and the alternative voices like mine, and they redirect people to the mainstream outlets like MSNBC or the Washington Post, or that were owned by Jeff Bezos, or the New York Times. So there is a kind of commercial interest on the part of these outlets in embracing this kind of open censorship. And you have seen it, articles by Rouse and others in the New York Times that laud this uncontrolled, unexamined, effort on the part of these digital platforms, unaccountable, to essentially impose censorship. And as Matt says, you know, it used to be that if you committed libel, you had to go to court and you had to, but that's all gone. So these digital platforms know everything about us. We know nothing about them. And they have the power to essentially reshape the narrative. And as I think the Democratic Party under Biden becomes more and more beleaguered because the policies they're clearly going to implement don't have popular support, this censorship will become more pronounced. That's my fear. I know that is Matt Taibbi's fear. That we just saw Glenn Greenwald leave The Intercept because the editors attempted to censor. They did censor his story on what was on Hunter Biden's laptop, and that's not conjecture, because Glenn released all of the traffic back and forth. And what did Naomi Klein and Betsy Reed and all these people at The Intercept do? They didn't respond to the textual evidence that Glenn released, and they went after, it was character assassination. They accused him of wanting to make more money on Substack and being a man-child. I don't know if that's the exact phrase Betsy Reed used. And I found that utterly appalling. As someone who walked out of the New York Times because they were trying to muzzle me over my criticisms of the invasion of Iraq, I can tell you it's extremely difficult without independent money, and neither Glenn nor I have it, to leave a stable, well-paid staff position for the unknown. What he did was quite courageous. Yeah, I think that there are people with integrity, Matt and Glenn being two, Robert Scheer, they're out there. But let's not be naive. They're not only very marginalized, but increasingly targeted and beleaguered.
In the realm of climate change, I know the books like Naomi Oreskes, Merchants of Doubt, and others like it have talked about the difficulty of creating the call to action for this terrific challenge that could end life on Earth in the not too distant future. I've seen books like Naomi Klein's older brother Seth's recent book called The Good War, about the analogy between war preparation by the Canadians for World War II and what is on the horizon now. But I've also seen a lot of people anxious about such a scenario because of the fear of what you might call corporatism and oligarchic domination of governance and, how would I say, making money for the corporations, not taking care of the, the challenge to all of our well-being. What's your vision of how we should address the climate challenge at this juncture? And what kind of reforms are needed to bring that to life?
Well, the war analogy doesn't work. And I speak as someone who spent pretty much 20 years covering war. War has all sorts of elements that environmental catastrophe lacks. War requires you to dehumanize the enemy. It's nationalism. It plays on nationalism, which is really a form of self-exaltation. It creates an existential threat that allows people to feel a sense of bonding or camaraderie. Just all of these elements of war don't work because the climate crisis is kind of a slow motion tsunami. And that's, of course, what is making it so difficult to deal with. It's incremental. It takes step by step, although, of course, at the end, it will be nonlinear. I mean, things will begin to break down. You'll have feedback loops where high temperatures then cause fires, then cause a reduction in crop yields, then cause methane leaks. Those feedback loops are probably already starting. I'm a strong supporter of Extinction Rebellion and have engaged in civil disobedience run by Extinction Rebellion. We shut down the street in front of the New York Stock Exchange because I think that, mass sustained civil disobedience is the only weapon. I think appealing to the ruling elites isn't going to work. I think history has kind of laid out that, all of the petitions and appeals to the UN and, efforts, lobbying efforts by the NGOs just haven't worked. The temperature rises, carbon emissions have risen. I think since 1990, they've risen by 40% of it. But anyway, they are unstoppable. The methods we have embraced to deal with the climate crisis haven't worked. That is essentially the bedrock position of groups like Extinction Rebellion, and I think they're right. So I think a mass civil disruption to save ourselves is all we have left.
Any other final thoughts? We've been covering a lot of different bases, a lot of different concern, a lot of different dysfunction, and underscored some really wonderful people in the middle and some beautiful writings. But I'm curious if you have final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners.
My final thought, and I speak as a member of the left, is that we must build real relationships with the oppressed. I think the danger is that the oppressed become an abstraction. One of the things I've liked about the George Floyd protests, number one, of course, it skews young, but also it's been led by people of color, and that I find that very heartening, by people who actually come out of the experience of urban oppression and police terror and know what they're talking about. I think there's been a political sophistication on the part of many of the people in the streets. They're not being gaslighted by Nancy Pelosi's kente scarf or Muriel Brower painting 35-foot-tall letters saying Black Lives Matter in front of the White House while she's African-American, while she also calls for a $50 million increase in the police budget and wants a bond issue to build a $500 million new jail. I think they get it. I find that very encouraging. But I think that one of the things that, you know, because I worked in Gaza, because I worked in Central America, because I teach in a prison and have taught in a prison for 10 years through Rutgers in the college degree program, I have close relationships with people who suffer the brunt of this oppression. And I think that keeps you honest. I can't walk out of that prison knowing that but for Clinton and Biden, half of my students wouldn't be in prison and then vote for Biden. I can't spend, as I did months of my life in Gaza, and then as I did in 2016, listen to Barack Obama give a speech to AIPAC, which, you know, might as well have been written and probably was written by AIPAC, and then betray the Palestinians. I think going back to the quote that you read from James Cone, the only thing that will save us is standing unequivocally with the people who have been crushed and demonized and oppressed by this system. And that in the short term, it may seem counterproductive. But in the long term, it gives us a kind of credibility, which I see slipping away by essentially selling ourselves out. And that's what worries me. That's what's dangerous. Because, you know, eventually, as Rorty, in the passage that I read, made clear that if you don't stand up for those values, then that just happened in Weimar, it happened in Yugoslavia, you have a population or a significant portion of that population that not only turns on that feckless, spineless liberal class, but essentially turns on the very purported values they claim to support, which I do support and which I think are important.
I want to underscore, as we sign off, you mentioned your work in the prisons, and I was fortunate enough to be able to join you for the showing of a play, I believe it was called Caged, that was created with you and I think Cornell and largely a number of people who had been incarcerated. And I thought that was a very, very powerful piece of testimony or art or whatever you want to refer to it. But it was an enormously powerful contribution. And I thank you for
thanks.
That.
That was published by Haymarket, and it was eventually performed in 2018 by the Passage Theater in Trenton. And COVID's thrown a monkey wrench into this, but we're trying to do an audio version of it, which is important because I still have a lot of students who are in the prison, and some of them are probably going to die in that prison, who wrote the play and can only hear it through WBAI. So my goal is to get an audio out there. And so they, and then hopefully, I don't know, if you never know through prison administrations what they censor and what they don't, but I want them to be able to hear it one day.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you, Chris. It's always very powerful and very inspiring to talk with you. And I hope you and your family are safe. And I look forward, perhaps as we get to the middle of next year, inviting you back to be in conversation once again. My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.